This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Welcome back, folks. Baseball Outside the Box, a show that interviews baseball's best coaching minds who love the challenge of status quo. I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. We are back for part two with Ryan Cienko, the assistant catching coordinator with the Los Angeles Dodgers. Check his bio out on the show notes. He's just not only with the Dodgers. He's done so much in the game of baseball. This has been a great talk, so we've gone to segment two on it. But check out his website, catchandthrow.com, and also his Twitter. He's on Twitter with some great advice there, at catchandthrow. You're going to go catch_and_throw, and that's his Twitter. All right, Ryan, we are back. Want to continue our talk. Now, we talked about throwing is where we ended up with the transfer into throwing. I know our audience loves some of the stuff you talked about. Anything else you want to mention about throwing before we get into the blocking aspect?
I think it's just a matter of repetition. You know, there's no need to practice it at the full distance. It's about what you can do or what you're doing at your body rather than just the result. So, again, get really good at catching the ball, getting it in your right hand, getting on that right leg. So then you can just push and go and throw. So you can do that work at 50, 40, 50, 60 feet. And then work your way back rather than just trying to do it at full distance and make it so taxing. So I would really focus on what you are doing rather than
right now.
What
every you know
is.
When you look at the catching position, you know, I know most people understand this. I hope they do. It has to be the top. You know, pitching and catching obviously have to be the top two positions because that's where the game happens all the time. But catching has so many important facets to it. We talked about the receiving, talked about the throwing. You know, we still got to get into the blocking aspect, which I'm assuming has a lot to it. So let's start our audience with, you know, your philosophy of, you know, how you begin to teach a young man how to block.
Again, I think it's just a extension of the catch. We showed the video yesterday or day before on how, you know, you are feeling your body get in position to catch the ball and get in the strongest position and how that actually puts you in position to go and continue that movement for the block. Again, I don't think they're two separate movements. I think if you get in position to catch, you can just continue it rather than say like, hey, okay, it's now time to be a blocker and make a totally separate move. So, we use the legs a lot. We use our lower half a lot as we reach and extend our workspace as a catcher. So if we can get in position by, say, a ball to our right, by dropping our left knee into position to create more leverage, now we're just closer to what we would have to do to go and block. So personally, I think that blocking, even at high rates of speed, is an easier task than we make it because we can just continue the move of catch and then turn over really, really late as far as our glove to be the block. The longer you give yourself with that first move, the easier it is because you're not changing positions, but also you're going to be more precise on where you've determined the ball is going to go.
You know, and I love the part when you talk about leverage, because that, again, folks, I saw this the other day on the field firsthand, and that's why I encourage you to go to catchandthrow.com. Check out where Ryan's at around the country, and if you get a chance, go there, see it in person. Because, Ryan, you know, to me, I always saw catchers kind of go, when they're going to the right, kind of go with the left and the right knee, and then you see them off balance or too far to the right. The way you taught it with the left knee down gave them more balance and more leverage.
Yeah, it just allows you to, you know, not only spread out your base, you know, you're kind of pushing the energy towards the ground to begin with, but you're getting that knee closer to where It needs to be as it comes down into the block. So, I just feel like using the legs really puts us in position and it allows us to be, again, more dynamic. So our body can work underneath us. And the more that our lower half is leading, our upper half doesn't have to make moves, which keeps us softer on top, but also keeps us
more balanced. So explain now, because you said it really well, you know, it's an extension or it continues. So you're catching a ball. So your glove is going where, uh-huh. you know, it's going to beat the ball to the spot. You don't necessarily drop before that. You have to first know where the ball is at.
Right. So, you know, even in a conventional way of thinking with a block, like you see it and you're going to where you think the ball is going to go. So, you know, what we really work on is understanding that your mm-hmm. body follows your hand. So when my hand is taking, you know, say the ball is just outside my right foot, I'm reaching to that position because I've determined mm-hmm. that the ball is going to end up right there, as if I were yep. going to pick it or if I were going to catch it. My body then will center up on that spot as I go. So, you know, the body trailing the hand is really important. Where we can get in trouble sometimes is that our hands flare, or they go up, or that they sail kind of just parallel to the ground, and our body wants to follow those as well. So, you know, I think it's really imperative that we, you know, we work forward towards the ball. I'm not saying like you're gaining a ton of ground, but our hand is going forward initially to say, hey, follow me. This is where I'm going. And then your body.
Well, I tell you what, I really like that. Again, visually, I saw it, but I even understand it now as you're discussing it, because what I'm thinking right away, what it tells me is when the hand is out there, you know, and the hand goes to the ball and it's getting the ball, you know, a lot of times the old way we would read, you know, the ball in the dirt and we would block. So now we're blocking more than we actually had a chance to catch that ball or even scoop that ball.
Right. And I think, you know, as a coach, this is where it gets a little muddy, because you need to allow the guys like some mess up room, some wiggle room. There's going to be times where we go to block balls we should have caught, and there's going to be times where we mm-hmm. want to catch balls that we should have blocked, you know? And I think the more experience you get, the easier that becomes. But also, there are going to be times where it's certainly easier for you to pick it, and you're really confident to pick it. And you're going to pick it, and it might have looked really bad, but you know, it happened really fast, and you know, your body might trail behind it. It might be in position, and you might mess it up sometimes. Like, I get it, but for the most part, it's a lot easier to catch the ball than it is to block it. And you know, if you have a young man or a young woman trying to go and get to a ball and their body is a tick late, but their glove is in position, there's going to be a lot of times it ends up in there. Absolutely. And then the body falls behind.
Absolutely. So, and take us through the pitch down the middle. I think this will simplify it. Pitch down the middle, low pitch, you're going out to get it. And then you've got to go to the blocking position, because I also heard you talk about, you know, be careful how much you curl or you cup in, you know, make a C out of your body.
Right. I think what you're talking about is more just like mm-hmm. keeping the ball in front of you. You know, as you reach for the ball, there's a limit to what we can do and still maintain balance and posture. There's a limit to where, you know, your upper body isn't going to take over from your lower body. So, you know, we need to find what that little bubble looks like. And the more that you use your legs, the further that extends. But then also, if you're in position, like, The scary one for me is the big pile of dirt, the great block on a ball that was going to bounce and hit you in the middle of the chest to begin with. That's the scariest one for me. And I think blocking down the middle sometimes is tough because of it, because we don't know which way to go. When I see that from a young athlete, like, you have to go and explain, like, all you have to do is just put one leg down. Your other one will come down. But literally, if you would have just closed your eyes, it was going to hit you in the chest. So we don't need to, you know, this is a great place to teach from, because you don't need you know, it doesn't have to be this great grand move to make great plays when you're just basically falling in front of the ball. There's not a huge like move that has to happen. Secondarily, like all we have to do is we have to keep the ball in front of us. There is a straight line between you and second base, whether you're 5 feet to your right or you're 5 feet to your left, that line exists. All we need to make sure of is that we keep the ball or that our body stays on the left side of the ball so we can just run through it and go straight. When we try to block back towards the plate, sometimes it gets us in bad positions. It also creates some you know, compromised angles to where the ball can go in different directions. And then it's just harder for us to not only get to the ball, but then it's further for us to create, you know, a route towards the target. So just keeping it in front of us is certainly the first key. If you feel like you need to angle a little bit,
right?
Who am I to say no? But, you know, staying flat on the baseball and staying right behind it or in front of it, however you choose to look at it, is the big key, because then it can absorb it.
Yeah, and what I liked about it is whether you go right or left, and you're, with the way you're teaching the blocking, you're keeping that straight line and same distance where we're not coming backwards. So I really like that a lot. I think our audience is going to like that. What I'd like to do, and I know it's difficult, as we said, but let's give our audience a little of a taste of, you know, a couple drills that maybe can help them, you know, teach this type of blocking.
With blocking, I mean, I don't want it to seem that that this is that different by any means. You know, it's just mm-hmm. off the premise of balance and posture. I think we just, again, have been told we have to do different things to block, and it's just streamlining or simplifying some of those moves. And certainly this is something that I learned from Tom many, many years ago, is to, you know, go through your checklist of balance and posture first. And if a guy is off balance and posture, you can make it more efficient. And really that's the premise of everything that I or anyone that is around us talks about when we're talking about catch, block, or throw. So, you know, it's not like I'm saying that everything that we're doing is wrong. I think it's just an easier way to do some of the moves. As far as drills go, we do the standard kind of three ball drill where, you know, you're isolating positions. I think the only thing that we think about differently is that we're catch, and then block. You know, making the move first being catch and keeping the move as catch, rather than, okay, I'm doing a blocking drill, now I'm a blocker. I think that trap is something that everyone falls into always. And we just need to keep the feel of, hey, I'm catching this. I can't reach it anymore. Now I need to continue this move into block. Then we'll move on to, you know, rolls, very slow rolls. So then, again, thinking catch and then beating the ball to the spot. Then very soft tosses. And then moving your way back. Again, I think you can use like a lacrosse ball when you're doing something soft. So the ball has to like react a little differently. It accelerates a little bit differently, especially when you're doing a soft toss. Sometimes the ball doesn't, you know, a baseball doesn't react off the ground or the dirt very well. So a lacrosse ball sometimes has a little bit more of a realistic bounce to it. And then we move, you know, we use like a hack attack, the machines, with Incrediballs and baseballs. One of the cool things about the machine, when you put those two things in there, one will react as a pitch and one will react as the ball in the dirt. The lighter flight of the Incrediball kind of makes it into a block, where the other one is a receiving. And that's where we can really start to blend to those moves and, you know, be in position to do all the things that we need to. You know, when it comes down to reacting and being ready for game-like situations. Again, when we're doing those moves, we have to remember that you were a catcher, and that you're not all of a sudden getting into this like goalie stance that you wouldn't get into in a game just because you're doing a catching drill. Blend those moves and make them as game-like not only with, you know, the setup, but also then how you go about receiving the ball or blocking the ball. And that's where we, you know, we can mess this up or really make it useful for us in our
great
skill development.
Stuff by Ryan Sanko, assistant catching coordinator with the Los Angeles Dodgers. We're continuing to talk about the catching position. There's some really good stuff here. Ryan, we're going to get into a couple more topics. We don't have that much longer to go, but wanted to make sure of a couple things. You know, as a catcher, you know, conditioning is important. Now, I know we can't get into everything you do with the conditioning aspect, but explain what you, with the Dodgers, what you guys do, conditioning, why it's different for the catching position possibly than in any other position.
I think it all has to do with recovery. To be perfectly honest, I don't have a lot to do with it. Our performance staff, we've got an incredible performance staff mm-hmm. that handles a lot of it. But I know our guys have very specific routines that they do, not only to prepare them to come out onto the field, but then get ready to, whether it's practice or compete, very, very strong, you know, with their core, with foam rolling and preparing their muscles. And they're really good about the work that they do after the game in preparation for the next day and their recovery. So honestly, I don't get into it too much. Mm-hmm. That's the luxury that we have. But our performance staff with the Dodgers is second to none. So they do an amazing job. And certainly they address anything that we see. So if there's a hip or ankle mobility issue, mm-hmm. all we do is go talk to them. They find the appropriate movements.
You know, but I love it. Even though you don't cover it, what's important, I think, for our coaches, and something I just got out of it, just from that, you know, small little discussion there, I got the word recovery. You know, when you hear recovery, you hear it a lot with pitchers, you know, but you don't hear it with catchers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're saying that basically a catcher, because of the position they're in all the time, the pressure on their body, that they need a recovery phase to be able to come back, because they got to come back the next day. It's not like a pitcher gets, you know, or at least a starting pitcher comes back every 4 or 5 days, or, you know, sometimes a closer may be out for a day. I mean, catcher needs time to recover or a workout to recover, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what's underrated is the amount of work that these men do, the amount of preparation that these men do. They are always ready. They are always ready, not only physically, but mentally and in their game preparation. So, you know, we mm-hmm. ask an awful lot of them, and they never ask for time off. So I think it's just a testament to what they know is expected to be, a catcher within our system. And with the goal of getting to the major leagues and competing against Yasmani sure. and Austin, it's a tall task. And unless you are up to that challenge, you might not want to apply. You know, I think that's the message that gets across, is that it's a thankless job. It's a job where, you know, we expect you to get this information on these 12 hitters, 13 hitters, know everything about them, not only be able to craft a game plan with your starters, but then against the relievers. And then, by the way, we're traveling tonight and you start a new series mm-hmm. tomorrow, and you need to be ready for them by the first pitch. So, you know, the mental grind that these young men have in their preparation, again, not only physically, but mentally and for their game planning and still being able to live their life and, you know, have a family and a girlfriend and
sure.
you know, bills and everything
Absolutely.
Else. Like, it's
and,
a
you
lot
know,
to add.
You know, I've had, obviously
task,
have an so. Advantage. I listen to you talk, and on the show, I can see where at the beginning you had mentioned that, you know, a catcher's got to be extremely intelligent, you know, and smart and be able to make decisions. And, you know, I can see where it's mentally taxing, as far as a position. Now, I had Larry Young, you know, current MLB Major League Supervisor for umpires and a former Major League umpire. We talked a little bit about some issues of, you know, that umpires might have or rules and regulations. But one of the interesting topics we mentioned and he talked about, which I heard you mention also, was the umpire-catcher relationship. Give our audience a little taste of what you tell your catchers to deal with, how to deal with the umpires.
I don't think it's just relationship building. That, you know, there's no way to deal with people other than, you know, being human and relating to them. We do have a bit of a more intimate relationship with umpires than maybe most players do, because we're working with them for hours on end every single day. You know, I think if there's anything to be said, it's just, you know, figuring out who they are, what, you know, knowing their name, knowing things that have happened or remembering things that they have talked about. And it's just basic relationship building as anything in business or, you know, just shoot in your personal life, you know, applies. I don't think there's anything to say other than that. You know, we're doing our job. We just need to allow them to do their job, and we're in business. You know, many times catchers get in the way, and this might have been where you were going with the question, but you know, we get in our own way by umpiring ourselves. And there's times, and I know there's a slide in the presentation where you know, you have a catcher catching a ball. He assumed it was a strike. He goes to throw it back. The umpire calls ball, and then he's all upset. We don't have the right to make that assumption. Our job is to catch it, present it to the umpire in a way that we want it to be presented, and then we allow him to make his decision. If he is not making the decision that we think, not only can we talk to him about it, but then we can also go back and figure out how we can craft certain pitches so he, you know, is compelled to say strike. I think this goes back to what we talked about at the very beginning. So, you know, our job is to catch it. His job is to call it. And when we start being the umpire and what we call self-umpiring, we get in trouble. So, you know, I guess that's part of the relationship, is trusting him that he's going to do his part. And there's going to be times where he'll say, oops, I messed that one up, or he's going to ask. And, you know, it's up to you to say if you thought it was a strike or a ball when he asks you that question. So it's about relationship building, and it's about trust. And the more you can work with the guy behind you, you know, two against one, in the same way that we talk about pitchers and catchers being two against one, you know, against the hitter, and how that gives us an advantage, you know, we now could do the same thing with umpires. And if we can have a working understanding of what we're doing, it allows us to maybe get some more favorable calls.
You know what? And the reason I wanted to bring that up, and you couldn't have said it any better. The reason I wanted to bring it up was because what I see at a lot of the younger levels, and this is, I believe that we got to reach the younger levels so that way when you get them, you don't have to change them within this philosophy. Because a lot of times you see them, you know, arguing about a call or the coach or the catcher. And what you're saying is, when you're arguing, you're probably not going to get the calls. But if you're smart about it, understand what, you know, what the strike zone is that he has that or she has, that you could actually get more calls by understanding that.
I think many of us can relate to this when we try to argue with our wives. You know, I mean, number one, you're not going to win. He already made the decision. And he's not going to just go like, you know what, you're right, strike. But second, you know, how you relate to people is how this thing is going to go down. And if it's a combative relationship, or, you know, like I said, if I argue with my wife, I lose. So I'm better off trying to understand what I need to do better.
Absolutely. It's part of the, you know, being a, like you said, a smart catcher, understanding all that. You know, Ryan, you've been great. You've gone longer than you should. I want to take you to one last segment, and I know you got a lot of work to do because you got a lot of, not just paperwork, but, you know, other things that you have to do with the Dodgers. Take us through, and folks, go to catchandthrow.com because you'll see it. You'll see count management, keeping the counts in the favor of the pitcher and the catcher. Let's talk about that, you know, the strategy between a catcher and a pitcher. And again, I know there's a lot to it, but give our audience kind of the, the most important aspect where they can build from there?
Well, we have a kind of a big initiative that we put in place a couple of years ago. Jeremy Zoll, who was our assistant farm director, is now the farm director with the Twins, took that role recently, kind of implemented what we call Game Calling University. So we have a huge emphasis on trying to not only catch the ball and get strikes, but then understanding how that changes the counts, and it puts us on a path of, you know, hopefully success and getting hitters out more than when we fall behind. So making sure that we are in the right position, calling the right pitches in the right times is huge. And then matching it up to what a hitter can and can't do. We tend to attack the weakness of the hitter quite a bit. And, you know, we know what his hips, his hands, his feet, his stride, what his barrel is doing. And it took a long time, not a long time. It took time for our guys to really start to recognize that. But once they did, they saw that they had success in gaining some count leverage, flipping a few counts. And like I said, we don't know what pitch is going to matter in the ball game. They started to get ahead. And if you look at the work that our men have done, and then you look at, you know, where our teams sit with their earned run average and our strikeouts, you know, we did really, really well this year. And it's a group effort. Our pitchers are going to get a little bit more involved this year, which is awesome. A little bit more involved with the same kind of work that our catchers have been doing. And now we can just, you know, create stronger steel, man. We're forging as much steel as possible. So, we're going to go and start attacking these hitters, from day one, in spring training, starting to look at lineups a little bit differently, starting to identify where damages could be done and, you know, who that damage could come from a little bit more frequently. And, you know, hopefully we can build on what
you know
we
what?
Did
and,
this,
you know,
this
in
past
the show,
year.
We have a lot of coaches, and obviously you have an advantage because, you know, in Major League Baseball, you guys have so many statistics. Basically science that tells you exactly what's going on or pretty close. Give our young coaches out there don't have all this, you know, information at their hands. An idea when you're looking at a hitter, whether it's batting practice or in a real game, how do you evaluate that hitter? Where do you start from, and how do you identify what that weakness is?
Yeah, I mean, to your point, our men get graded on every single ball that they catch. I receive a report every day that gives us a scouting grade, a 20 to 80 grade on how they caught the ball. How they went about their work that day, based on the probability of pitches being called strikes and our ability to not only keep strikes, you know, balls that would be called high probability of strike in the strike zone, you know, getting called strikes, but then also on the other side of it. You know, if it's not a 50-50 ball, if it's a 35% strike and we get it, great. And then we just figure out how we can do that more. That's like what you're saying. We have the advantage because we do have technology.
But you also read the hitter's swing.
Absolutely. So when we're going, before that, prior to that, we're certainly looking at that when we're looking at video or even when we're watching batting practice. Sometimes there's a new player that we didn't know about that was activated or brought up. So you can go and either, number one, probably we go back on video and try to find it. But if you can't, you just go and watch him take BP. You know, we look at where his feet are in the box. Is he close to the plate? Is he off the plate? Are his feet closed or his feet open? We're going to look at, where his hands are, where his hips are. Are his front hip flying out? Is it staying in? Are his hands tight? Are they high? Are they stuck? You know, where is the stride going? You know, is the stride going away or into the plate? Is it even? And then, you know, very importantly, we're looking at what the barrel does. You know, if we look at a tall barrel, you know, a steep barrel, and it has a tip, well, it's going to come undone in a certain place. If it's more of a flat barrel, if it's, you know, it's going to come down maybe a little bit higher in the zone. So we're going to look at all those things, and then that's where we start to put our game plan together. But I think whether you have the deafening amount of information as we do or not, you can certainly look at those, you know, four or five things: where the feet are, what the hip is doing, you know, what is the stride doing, where are the hands and where is the barrel, and then you can figure out where the damage could happen. And if you can stay away from that and it matches up to what your pitcher can do, then, you know, you go from a pretty high success rate of getting someone out to, you know, a certainty of getting a hitter out. And that's kind of
and an obvious one. If we started anywhere, if you took a hitter that steps away from, you know, home plate, you know, he exposes himself to the middle away. And that's what you're talking about, being able to identify that.
Right. Well, I mean, it just depends. Like, shoot, you could have mm-hmm. Barry Bonds, who stood on top of the dish. Mm-hmm. He can stride away and still cover. But you could have a guy like, I mean, it could be, say, Jack Clark. It just comes to mind, like, stands way off the plate with a closed stance. If that hip or that stride goes open, then you're right. Like, there's nothing on the outer half he could hit. I know those are two very different kind of hitters and different eras, but you know, you have to look at all those things. Where is he in the box? If he's on the chalk, he mm-hmm. can stride open and cover everything. If he's more in an even spot, I think the toughest hitters are going to be the guys that are really even feet, even hands, even hip, you know, more of a flat barrel that can cover the middle part of the zone. Those are tougher because the big part of where pitchers mm-hmm. throw the ball is covered by them. You know, that pesky, everybody knows that kind of hitter, like that pesky little two hitter that's not going to swing and miss a ton and certainly doesn't strike out. Well, that's the kind of guy that you might want to put high up on your list of, we don't want him to beat us because he might go and have a 15 pitch at bat because we're going for a strikeout. Instead, let's just find where he does the least amount of damage, throw a ball there, get him out of the batter's box, and move on to the guys that we have a better chance of getting out in less pitches. And that might be, again, that might be the game. It might be you're planning on the number six hitter, the number seven hitter, who's that pesky guy that just matches up to your pitches, that instead of, you know, him up there for 24 pitches in the day, he's up there for seven, mm-hmm. and your pitcher got to go another inning, you know, your starter. So I think that all goes into the, you know, into the planning and into the maturity of your hitter, I'm sorry, your catcher and your pitcher. So they understand, like, hey, this is important where this guy is, but not only where he is, but how sure. is he, how are we going to get him out? It's going to be the kind of person that's going to give us fits. We'll identify him as that kind of person and treat him accordingly, just as you would, you know, Stanton, where it's like, he's the most dangerous guy on the field, but we think we can get him out quicker than this guy.
You know, and big thing that comes up all the time, big question comes up about catchers. And I love to bring it up to get different opinions. That's calling pitches. Where do you guys stand? Is there a time where you're calling the pitches and then it goes to the catcher, or how do you start to develop a young man in that?
We educate them and then we awesome. Support the crap out of them. I think that's the biggest way to go about it is, you know, you get catchers, they're pretty green mm-hmm. coming out of college or high school because sure. they've been yep. told what to throw for their whole life. They're very excited to now have some ownership in it, which is awesome. I think that's, as a coach, I think that's one of the best things is watching the guys get excited about game calling, because now they are empowered to make decisions rather than being told. And you just go ahead and let them go. I think I think we spoke about yep. this at some point this weekend, that, hey, the difference between me, a high school coach or a college coach is that when Trav and I are working with players, we can play this as slow as we want because he doesn't need to be ready for 3 years, 4 years. If we get a 17-year-old kid in the DR, I'm hoping in a couple of years he gets to the United States, not, hey, he's going to be calling game seven of the World Series in the United States. So we have more time to educate them and allowing them to fail fast forward and then re-educating and helping make better decisions than, say, a college or a high school where, you know, this game might be the entire season. And that's how you're being graded. So, you know, we're in this development business, which is a long, slow play to help this guy as he progresses. And, you know, say his bat carries him quicker. Great. Maybe we have to speed up the process, but it's still a longer play. And I would say that's a definite advantage that we have because you can go and basically get your, you know, your game calling university degree over time rather than
and
hey,
our this is, development is the word coaches around the world and in the U.S. you know, especially you young coaches that are working, the volunteers who are giving your time and working hard with our young players. Listen to what Ryan just said, development. So I know on Baseball Outside the Box, we strongly believe in the same development process that he just talked about with our young kids, whether they're 10, 11, or 12. Get them started, let them make some mistakes, learn from the mistakes, and then teach them along the way. Because remember, you're in a development business. You're not in a winning business. You know, when you get older, you get to high school, college, as Ryan mentioned, yeah, there's times, you know, that your job's on the line. You got to win. So maybe you've got to make certain decisions. But if we can get them young and doing that, it's going to be a lot easier for the high school coach. That's how important your position is at the grassroots level with volunteers. Ryan, you also mentioned, and this is interesting, you said attack the weakness. And the question would be, I'm going to attack the weakness. What happens if I don't have the pitch or the ability to hit that weakness location-wise? Do I make an adjustment?
Yeah. Sure. First, let me go back for what you just said. I absolutely agree with you, and I believe the toughest thing when you're coaching at any level is that not only the fear of losing, but the want to win, right? And I think kind of goes both ways. I mean, my first real big coaching thing is I coached 8 year olds, right? I had a travel team of 8 year olds where I had like five big leaguers kids on my team. So I'm looking at it going like, oh boy, I gotta be really good at this. The good thing about having five big leaguers as part of my like parent group was they knew like, hey, this is just a development thing. And it actually taught me a lot that we just need to get them better. So they're really better when they're nine. And then hopefully they're a little better when they're 10, because we're trying to get them in the end game to get to high school. And, you know, then as being a high school coach, what I really appreciated is the kids that were prepared enough to know that they had to stretch and know they had to, you know, do their preparation. And, you know, it had nothing, not as much to do about the skill set because they're growing and they're getting better. So, you know, I haven't coached in college, but now coaching on the professional level, I've kind of done all of the different stages and I see exactly what you're saying. It's just, it's hard sometimes because you feel like you're going to be judged on winning where the kids being happy and the kids developing really is the end.
Sure, and you said, you know what, you brought up a great point. I'm glad you really brought that up from your perspective because you also mentioned parents. Well, it's educating the parents in that because the coach can want to do it, but if the parent doesn't understand why, then you're going to have problems with your team, obviously. Yeah, we've all been there. So,
in the past too.
But at least hopefully we're reaching out to a lot of people out there, you know, especially our volunteers. God bless them for what they do. Ryan, two more things that, you know, tell me about the attack the weakness. Then I just want you to address the count management chart you have on your website a little bit, just to give their audience an idea.
Sure. When we're talking about attacking weaknesses, you know, you need to identify more than one spot because, you know, sometimes you got to go to plan B or plan C. And as your question, you know, was kind of leading, like what happens when you don't have that, you know, you got to go to plan B. And then sometimes you got to go and just play the safest spot you can. You know, he covers everything and I don't have anything to get him out. Well, try to find the, you know, the most likely place where he's not going to kill you, you know? Sure. And I think that's kind of how you go about it. It doesn't matter what level you are, you're at, if you're, you know, able to somewhat throw the ball near a target, you know, again, like I said, I coached 8-year-olds. It was, yeah. Hopefully we throw strikes today, as the big main goal. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you're coaching 8-year-olds, 10-year-olds or 25-year-olds, that's kind of how the game goes. Like if you throw strikes, you have a much better chance of winning. Now we can go, you know, a little bit deeper dive on that and say like, hey, we need to get ahead with this pitch. And by the way, he studied the last 10 times that you've faced him and you've thrown that same pitch. You better be careful. But then it's just audibles off of those, you know, those kind of themes where we can get better. And, you know, there are going to be times where you have nothing to throw the guy and you just throw him whatever you're the most confident with in a place where you feel like he can do the least amount of damage and then get the next guy up that you might be able to
and lastly, on your website, catchandthrow.com, you have the count management and, you know, some of it's pretty obvious, you know, you're talking about counts, but kind of explain that chart, why you did that.
Sure. So, I know I just put a new one up there for the 2017 averages as well. So, you know, it's just a tree basically and understanding how, listen, if you get on the right side of this map, it's green, you know, I think I color coded as green and red. So you know, you have green going on one side where batting average, your ISO, your WOBA, which is just a weighted on base percentage, and ISO it's just a really good way to, judge power and damage. How it significantly goes down if you can get into 0-1, 0-2, 1-2, 2-2 counts. You know, if you're able to do that, the chances of you winning each at bat goes through the roof. So when over 50% of counts get into two strike situations, you'd much rather, if you're going to get to two strikes, stay on the right side of that map where it's 0-1, 0-2, 1-2. Even if you get to 1-1, like the damage is still pretty significant. So getting that first pitch strike sets you on the right path, at least, to go and have more success against the hitters. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just playing odds. We're playing the odds as best we can. And if we can I don't know the exact number offhand, but I know it's like if you can get to 0-2 or 1-2, like the chance of you striking a guy out goes to like almost 40% or something like that. So, you know, you get into a position to where you can minimize damage and then you just start taking your chances. And that's why we play the game. You know, sometimes they're going to hit it. Sometimes you're going to win, but you're stacking the odds in your favor by getting into counts where, you know, you are ahead as the pitcher and the catcher rather than the hitter being ahead. Because if the hitter is ahead, he gets to take more risks, be a little bit more picky with what he wants to swing at. And then, you know, the numbers go through the roof as far as, you know, what the hitter's damage can do. And that's all hitters. It's not just the guys with power. And if you go through and I know as I was making this chart, there are games, which I didn't know. I just assumed every count would come up in each game. But if you look at the cumulative stats of 2017, there's quite a few games. There's a couple hundred games in the season where it didn't go to 3-0 in the game at all.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is surprising. You know, so there are times where the pitchers can, you know, get ahead and stay ahead and get into those 2-0 counts, which happened every single game, and the 3-1 counts, which happened in every single game. All the other counts happened in every single game that was played, but there were some games where 3-0 didn't happen. So, you know, if you fall behind 1-0, no big deal, get back to 1-1. If you know, because the 2-0, 1-1 differences in not only average, but power and on-base percentage, it like goes up significantly. So, if we're able to manage the counts a little better and create some leverage for us, it just allows us to win more ball games. And when you're in that pitcher catcher kind of fight or grind together, it makes your day a heck of a lot easier when you're controlling the count rather than.
And what I love about it is I wanted our coaches to go to the website again, because when you take a look at the chart, remember, go to catchandthrow.com. When you look at the chart, a lot of visuals are great for young pitchers and catchers to understand. And when you see visuals like this, then young kids get a pretty good understanding of what a coach means when they say throw strikes. Easier said than done, but that's why they should be practicing that more and more, because the percentages are important to understand. Ryan, last thing, we always end the show on this. There's so much to what we discussed, and I know there's a lot more we can talk about, and we're definitely going to have to do another show. Maybe there's something out there that we didn't talk about you felt was important to let our audience know that we missed, maybe, and then we'll end the show from there.
I don't know if there's anything that we really missed, but I think if there are some takeaways from what we've talked about today, it's one, controlling the strike zone, both in your preparation and then as the ball hits your glove. We just need the ball to stay as close to the zone as possible. Allow the umpire to do his job and say strike as much as possible. I would say those are the two biggest takeaways that in any talk or discussion that I get in about catching, which I'm the self-proclaimed kind of nerd of catching. I worry way too much about how people catch baseballs. But it does matter in the context of our game. When you get to watch it on a high level every single day, you realize that there are some that are better than others. We are blessed with the Dodgers to have a bunch of guys that are really, really good at it. Not only Austin, Barnes, and Yasmani Grandal up in the big leagues, who are, just depending on which leaderboard you're looking at, you're talking about two of the top three catchers in baseball with how they catch the baseball. But then it trickles down into our prospects, and even the guys that we've newly signed. We signed a new player, and I've been over the last few days in constant contact of educating and giving him as much information as possible. These guys, they love it. They know that a big part of their job is serving their pitching staff. I think once you get a young catcher involved and he gets to feel not only, the contact and the involvement in every play, but then some investment in what that pitcher is doing, then you've got, the catcher hooked for life, as far as I'm concerned.
And folks, we are at the end of the show, but if you didn't know, Baseball Outside the Box has hit an historical event. We have never in the history of the show, very short history, but in the history of the show, ever made an audible like this. We went and made two shows out of one, and Ryan didn't know about it. I want to thank Ryan for his time. Believe it or not, we're at 1 hour and 50 minutes or 42 minutes, which we're going to break the show into two shows because of that. And Ryan, just want to thank you, one, for all the great information, two, for your extra time, because it was not something we had discussed, and I know you got a busy schedule getting ready for spring training soon. So again, it was a pleasure being with you in Curacao. We look forward. You're going to see Ryan more on the International Sports Group tours around the world. Don't forget to go to catchandthrow.com and also his Twitter, catch_and_throw. Check out all his great stuff on Twitter. Ryan, again, God bless you, and thank you really for being on the show, Baseball Outside the Box.
You got it, buddy. This has been a pleasure, and it's been awesome spending some time with you here in Curacao.
Absolutely. Learned a lot. Say hi to your family. And folks, don't forget, we are all over social media. Catch us at Twitter at Baseball Out, our website, baseballoutsidethebox.com, and our email, info@baseballoutsidethebox.com. Send me all your questions. Remember, coaches' education is the key to building the foundation of our sport. So keep getting smarter by listening to the show, the interviews, baseball's best coaching minds, with innovative thoughts that love the challenge, the status quo. I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. Have a great coaching day, and I'll see you on the next show.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm. This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.